welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 131, the Tibet House US Conversations, Robert Thurman and Sharon Salzberg.
So Sharon, thank goodness. How are we going to do this, Sharon?
We're just going to have a conversation, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we started that. Okay. So you want to start, Sharon? If you like, you can go first.
Sure. Hi, my name is Sharon Salzberg, and I want to introduce my host, Professor Bob Thurman. Bob is a magnificent friend and great teacher and scholar for all his incredible accomplishment as a scholar and really deep and broad thinker. I actually think of Bob as a person of a lot of devotion, that he's incredibly committed and caring about the well-being of others, about the state of the world, and I just think of that devotional quality where he's kind, he shows up, he's present. That's a really kind of incredible match to his fascinating brain.
That's so kind of you, Sharon, really. So anyway, I want to introduce my guest, Sharon Salzberg, who actually I'm sure most everybody knows, who is a totally wonderful friend. And we have been working together now for, is it 15, 20 years? I don't know. It's like a long time. And she's the greatest friend of Menla Mountain Retreat, which is Tibet House's healing center and meditation center in the Catskills. And she herself is the founder, of course, Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, where we go back like 40 years, back to when I was at Amherst nearby, used to go over there, and she and her colleagues there used to come to our American Institute of Buddhist Studies activities in Amherst. And she is a bodhisattva. I was just reading this morning a book about Tara, the great woman who, when offered the chance by some sage, or recommended that she become a man so she could be a Buddha after being like a fantastic bodhisattva. She said, the heck with that. There's so many boring male Buddhas. Permanently, I'm going to be then a female bodhisattva everywhere throughout the world and emanate myself all over the place. So I think of Tara as Sharon as Tara, which means loving all beings and effectively working to help them find a better life. And Sharon has, you know, indefatigably traveled all over the U.S. and Europe and Russia and everywhere teaching mindfulness. And she's a major force in this huge mindfulness movement. Of course, many strands of it have gone in directions that she didn't necessarily go. But she has been the engine of it, I would say, really. There are other teachers in the centers, and they stay in their centers. And Sharon has taken the center all over the country with tremendous passion and love for everyone, and sympathetic, attending to their mental suffering that everyone has, and helped so many people, I think, find a better state. So I couldn't be more honored than having Sharon here on this podcast. It's really wonderful, Sharon. And then her latest book, of course, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection, is really real, My wife and I recently celebrated our 50th anniversary, and Nina, my better half, or more than half, my better three quarters, I'm the quarter. And I thought a lot about your book, Sharon, because people asked a lot of us, like, you know, what advice do you have? How did you make 50 years? And all this kind of thing. And all I was thinking was read Sharon's real life.
Oh, you're so sweet.
And in a way, you could another title could be realistic love. In other words, do you really keep the love going in the midst of irritations and problems and stresses and sufferings and occasional imperfections, etc.? Is really, you know, you have so much true advice and good advice and insightful remedies. It's really wonderful.
And, well, thank you, and massive congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I especially am to be congratulated. The poor woman had to put up with me for 50 years. Unbelievable. Good karma for her for many future lives. And and I'm trying, and she's helped me learn. She's my third major, my first two being Geshe Wangyal and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and she's definitely the third. And I have lots of other teachers, of course, such as you. So so how are you feeling, actually? You've been traveling a lot and doing real love and offering it to people and discussing it with them. And how does it feel after a few months of doing that? And what do you think?
Well, I mean, one of the best thing is getting to be with so many wonderful people and talking about love and exploring love and, you know, taking a look at love. And you know, traveling, as you know, is extremely difficult. And the other day, I was supposed to meet somebody yesterday, your birthday, and I was in California the day before that, so this person wrote and said, are we actually getting together? And I wrote back and I said, well, you know, I do have to fly in, so unless I end up in Detroit, well, you know, we'll do it. And then I was in the airplane the next day, and we got over to Detroit, and the pilot said, well, weather's really bad in Newark. We're going to have to circle for a while. And I thought, why did I say that? You know?
Oh, no.
But then we did land, so everything was fine. But travel is arduous.
I know. I think it's getting more so because the things are so crowded. The world is so... Yeah. People are rushing hither and thither in the middle of the stress of everything. It's amazing. Airports are like gauntlets. I find.
That's true.
And it gets more and more like that. Here in Woodstock, everyone is saying it's the most crowded summer people have ever seen, even though it's been an exceptionally rainy one, which I love, actually, although now and then it is nice to see in the warm sun. It's something about the volume of the leaves on the trees. They're practically bulging out over roads and things, you know, this vast green thing. And I sort of see in them the future soil that when they all fall down this fall, you know. I've never seen such a volume of leaves. Apparently from the water, you know, the sun, sun has not been so prominent, but the water. So that's really, really good. You're in the city now.
Yes, you're in the country. How is Menla Mountain?
Yes, we were there. We had a wonderful series of retreats at Menla in Phoenicia. We had a long yoga retreat with Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor, who came over from Boulder and who have for the like sixth or seventh time, it's become a tradition. And it was really great. It was a whole week long and everybody had a really great time. I did it, managed to get a little yoga in, which I need always. And then we discussed the goddess. It was focused on the female Buddhas, female and Hindu goddesses, and how powerful and important they are in Indian civilization. And that was really fruitful and very, very interesting. And we learned a lot from each other, you know, and from the text that we were looking at. And then we went on to that. I have a group who have gone to Kala Chakra initiations from His Holiness. And I have a group of 40, 50, 60 people who are trying to learn to do the sadhana. And of course, Kala Chakra, as you know, you've been a couple of times, I think. And it's so complicated, 722 different different deities in the different parts of the mandala, and it's just unbelievable. But they, of course, one can practice the essence of it without, creating kind of a positive image of the world, a positive image of the self, to be able to cope with the ordinary world and try to transform it in a positive direction. And that you can do, though, without having to go through all the detail, although it's important ultimately to do all that detail. So it was really fun, and I did a fire puja at the end, and it's just lovely. People, of course, are the most lovely things, when they're in happy and they're doing something positive and they feel they're evolving toward being more awake. It's just wonderful. As you know, that's what keeps us going, isn't it? You teach so many.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm so inspired by everyone who practices and who really, people want to see not only a difference in themselves, but a difference in the world. And it feels like such a fragile time in a way. And it's been interesting, people saying, looking at themselves, saying things like, I can't abide the level of hatred I'm living in, myself. Yeah. That I'm generating. I know something has to change, or I'm afraid all the time now, which is not unreasonable for a lot of people. And yet I have to find a source of strength. And
yes.
People's willingness. I think one of the things that has afflicted us as a society is thinking of qualities like love and compassion as sort of weak and saccharine and giving in and losing intelligence and thinking of qualities like vengefulness, as strong and giving us the strength we need to take action. Otherwise, we'll just kind of sit there, being able to, willing to, and even demanding, re-examining all of that and really trying to see, well, what makes me strong? And, am I really as alone as I think? Or, how do I get happy? Is it the same old habit patterns, or does something need to shift? And it's very exciting.
That is great. And do you see progress when you meet with people? You've been traveling with this message, focus of your eternal message, in the midst of these kind of marches on Washington and, town meetings of aggrieved ordinary people who are not really represented in the administration currently, and so on. How does it seem? Do you think they'll be able to sustain,
Well, I mean, with whatever skills I have to offer, I'd like to help them because I think it's great, I think that the voice of the people is, one of the best things about democracy and the nonviolent assertion of one's views is really important. But to do that not from a place of hatred and not sort of the brittleness of hatred, which I think is not sustainable anyway.
Yes.
It's too self-destructive. And so finding other sources of strength and having a big vision of the world, people coming together or the truth that our lives are interconnected, even if we can't stand somebody. That I think is really important.
It is. It's like we can't stand, but we have to find sympathy. Like these people, for example, in the White House, they're just completely like, it's like the craziest, zaniest thing. it's unimaginable what they're doing. Like this guy, I missed sort of the whole, because of my bigger retreat, I missed the whole event of Scaramucci.
Yeah.
But I couldn't even believe what I heard indirectly about it. I never really saw the guy functioning. But it seemed so completely incongruous. What is it, with those people? And then that must generate some kind of sympathy. And on the other hand, the one thing, why is it that the people who are now feeling, left out, right? There's, we had Obama kind of protecting us, we felt. Even though the Congress was really bad from the very beginning of Obama, but at first, except when Nancy was taking care of things, but now with no protector, so everyone is really stirred up, and yet they seem to still be squabbling amongst themselves. What are we?
Yeah.
How can they do that in the midst of, you know, there's no notion of uniting against a common problem, you know? Doesn't seem to, or there's some, I guess, but it doesn't seem to be much, does it? Or you've been more exposed. What do you think?
Well, I think it's difficult. Of course, the human mind can be very difficult, but I think in the face of what, many would perceive as cruelty, like the wholesale discounting of other people as people and, the needs one has and the sort of incredible anguish one goes through in, it's very real, people having to choose between food and medicine for their kids.
Oh, that's just so
I mean, it's horrible. And, hopefully the kind of witnessing of that much potential suffering will bring people together. But, the ego, the kind of egotistical claims of being right or best are difficult. It's like we talked about sympathetic joy a little bit in your introduction of me. You know, it's often considered a difficult state to actually be happy for others and and not to feel jealous or envious. And my teachers, like my Burmese teachers, would say it's often much harder than compassion.
Yes.
For us. So I don't know what you think about that.
Yes. Well, in that, in the four immeasurable states that you have there in the Theravada tradition, that is a not well examined by people other than you. About how when you have immeasurable compassion, which brings up the immeasurable love below it into it, then the way of saving yourself from getting overwhelmed by the suffering that compassion opens itself to, I guess, is to find some ground of joy in the midst of it all, you know, somehow. You know, but that seems very hard on the surface. I recently read, I had a mailing, you know, fundraising mailing from Oxfam and Yemen, Ethiopia, Somalia, Nigeria were the four particularly picked out. Starvation, huge level of starvation going on and because of drought and social dislocation and corruption in the ruling classes and, you know, robbing the money, you know. And that they do in those places. And it's just, and violence, of course, Somalia. Like, and then when you look at that and then and look at the people's condition and then how to find immeasurable joy there, how do you respond to that? How do they, what do they say in Buddhaghosa's commentary or whatever? Or they just, what? Do they actually really address
it? I'll tell you what I say. I can't really tell you what Buddhaghosa says. I'll tell you what I say.
Okay,
I can't really
what do
tell
you say?
You
yes, that's what, yes.
You know, I think, it, of course, it's hard. And we can't lose sight of the suffering and try to disguise it in some way. But it's two things. One is a person is more than their ordeal, you know? People... you know, in dire straits can have like tremendous love for their families or their neighbor or endeavor or sheer grit to survive. I mean, all kinds of things that we also need to honor and pay attention to. And then there's also, also from the Theravada, there's a whole sort of section of the teaching called gladdening the mind. You know, where just sort of the naked confrontation with suffering over and over and over and over and over again can be too devastating because the point is, you know, at least as far as I understand, suffering in Buddhist teaching is not redemptive. It's not the fact that we suffer because everybody suffers, but it's how we relate to that suffering, you know, like
how
much presence, how much understanding, how much compassion are we bringing to bear with that suffering. And so we need to kind of restore, we need some energy, you can't just be exhausted, you need some wherewithal, some sense of inner resource, and that's part of what we need to cultivate so that when we do look at suffering, it's not to be crushed by it.
Right.
But to be able to actually look at it. And so all those practices like generosity, morality, loving kindness are part of gladdening the mind. And something I said to somebody recently who confronted me somewhere about, you know, why should we be happy until everyone can be happy and it's lazy. And I said, look, you know, you look at those photos or movies of civil rights workers and demonstrators marching. They didn't march crying, they marched singing. Why was that?
Yes. That's really good. Yes, the singing, they sing. And people singing, especially and also in chorus, gives a kind of joy and a sense of connection, resonance with each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then they're walking like Martin Luther King's people, they're walking toward the attack dogs and the batons and the hoses. But the singing, they're sort of, they're emanating kind of joy, actually.
Yeah.
And that, of course, immediately they get hit and then they lose track of that. But yes, I guess that's very good. This brings me to a question I wanted to ask you for a really long time. This is a great place. Now, your lineage loyalty has you always refer to the Burmese tradition, with the Theravada tradition in Burma. Although in ancient time, of course, Burma had the other vehicles of, you know, Mahayana and Vajrayana.
Yeah.
And I criticize, just let me just preface this question by saying I like to criticize and argue with Tibetans who consider themselves Mahayana, because they have a concept called the integration of three teachings, three vehicles. But they always think that the high, what they think is the higher one includes the lower one, is how they define that.
Right.
So I always say, no, the lower one includes the higher one too, if they're really integrated. So you have Mahayana and Vajrayana in Theravada. That's my slightly heretical theory. And how do you have also studied with teachers, and you have lineage, therefore, in Mahayana and even in Vajrayana.
Yeah.
Very, very devotedly. But you're kind of cautious about hailing from that tradition in a certain way. You know, you always go to the ground tradition, which I honor you. I think that's actually good, because that's where you did your main, your strongest practice and main training in the original training, let's say. You know? So what do you think? How do you integrate this in yourself, in your own mind, in other words?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more integrated in me just because of the ways I've changed, you know, doing other practices or working in other contexts. But when I teach, as you know, I try to keep things very simple so that it's a practical experience for people.
And you do that well.
Mm-hmm. My goal is always that people leave with a little more confidence in their ability to carry it out, because I'm a big believer in daily practice. And although I know you like the word performance, you can call it daily performance, actually. That works too. But, you know, I think this is not practice as opposed to study. This is practice as compared to fantasizing, like, won't it be nice when I'm enlightened, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and having just a kind of abstract appreciation of the possibility without ever doing anything about it. And so I really want people to have confidence and greater confidence and clarity. And so the methodologies that I teach will be right out of the Burmese tradition. And so I just, you know, I kind of work from that perspective. But within me, you know, of course, I've been influenced and changed by many of the great beings I've encountered in different traditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and I think there is the you know, you also have in the Burmese tradition the idea of the bodhisattva.
Yes.
And all of the altruistic element. And then this question, for example, the movement from the immeasurable compassion, heavenly plane, contemplative plane, to the immeasurable joy, contemplative plane, sympathetic joy, involves some kind of universalizing, you know, seeing the deeper level where beings, as you said so eloquently just now, where they have some kind of positive thing, and even in the midst of it. But boy, looking at one of those starving children, like just skin and bones, you know, in Africa, it's very difficult to see. Actually, I find it impossible to see anything good about that. It makes me upset. I don't see joy. I find it really difficult to see joy in that, except for the future life issue, you know, when people die senselessly and when they're innocent as youth, the fact that they're not ultimately gone, they just forfeit that body and they'll be still continuing and they'll be relieved actually of the pain of that body. To me, the multi-life perspective is essential. I don't know why, you know. I get distressed that there are some trends in modern Buddhism, in American, what they think of as modern Buddhism, American Buddhism, where they think, well, we just don't need that, you know. It really upsets me a little bit. I was just reading a book by a scientist who was trying to say, Buddhism is true, is the title of his book. And that, which is nice, you know, giving scientific imprimatur to some mental aspects of Buddhism, right, the mental effects. But then he says, of course, I don't mean reincarnation, he says. I mean the sort of rational parts of Buddhism. So where did they get that idea? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I mean, my teachers would say, you know, because people, of course, would always ask, and you know, about different planes of existence or past and future lives, and they would say, you don't have to believe it. They said, it's true, but you don't have to believe it. You know? So I kind of take it from that, you know, because they too were, or it's a little bit similar maybe to the Dalai Lama talking about secular ethics, you know?
Yes.
If you're not a person of faith of a certain kind, where do you derive your sense of good-heartedness from and the importance of ethics and so on? He's saying we can, you know, somewhere.
Right, right. Well, I agree with him on that, actually. But I have another thing where I see Shakyamuni Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
As by teaching the karma theory, he's doing secular ethics in relation to Vedic Brahmanism. You know, in the sense of secular ethics means that you are ethical because it makes sense to you in a causal nexus.
Right.
Rather than you do it because God told you or will punish you if you don't. And, you know, which is what holds together. So their faith is the faith in some divinity. You know, but then the scientists are so intent upon no future life because of their aversion to the Abrahamic religions that they insist on putting that in the category of unevidenced belief, which it isn't in that category. There is evidence for it. Although I admit, I must say, Buddha even said there, no description of relative processes is an absolute dogma. Buddha did say that, of course, as well. That's what they mean when they say you don't have to believe it. It's not an absolute dogma, but at some level, maybe you'll encounter it, type of, I think is what they mean, talking to Westerners. So that has stirred me, for example, in Stephen's work, that he does that. He lumps it into, you know, reincarnation would have to be a blind faith belief, which I don't think so, you know. Because people do remember previous lives.
People do remember, it's true.
They really do. And there's a lot of documented things. People have no motive to say it, you know. It's not extraordinary. They're not getting on, you know, they're not getting on Larry King by remembering.
No one's getting on Larry King anymore.
Well, I know that, you know, or whoever is the equivalent, you know.
he might be doing specials.
What?
So he might be doing special interviews, so maybe he could do the reincarnation special or something.
Yeah, I should do that. I'll try. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to interview that guy who wrote that book, Buddhism is True. He wants me to interview. His name is Wright.
Yeah, I know.
And he wants me to interview him so sometime this month, and I'm going to. And I'll discuss this with him, you know. And then, of course, to me, the final, and it's amazing, I've been worried about this for like 30, 40, maybe 50 years, ever since I saw the idea of beginninglessness of life, you know, it became a visceral experience for me. But it took me 45 of those years maybe to realize that if someone has the belief that by when their heart stops and their brain goes flatline, that they will be nothing, right? There'll be no consciousness forever. There can never be evidence for that. People, you know, scientists can only assert that that must be so, but there's no evidence because, you know, there's no brain activity, there's no heart activity, but consciousness is not only brain activity and heart activity, we've seen. And So that doesn't mean that there's nothing. In other words, they didn't find anything, but it doesn't prove that the person, the subjectivity of the person, is nothing. So that has, and not only doesn't it prove it, but they never will prove it. Because you can't prove nothing. Right?
Right.
It's not there to be proven. So therefore, that means that that belief is a blind faith belief. It's, you know, in principle. Right? It's an acausal blind faith belief. Anyway, when I discuss with that kind of person and we run into that point, it gets them thinking, at least, which is all that one can hope for. Anyway, I sort of feel it's important for people to feel they're committed to be entangled with everybody and everything endlessly, to really take it seriously somehow. What do you think?
Well, I hope people can take it seriously without deep conviction about that, because this comes back to the Dalai Lama's point about secular ethics. There are more people who don't believe it than do, and it would be awfully nice to have people kind of reform ethically, you know?
Yes.
And be less greedy and hateful and harmful to one another, to the planet, so...
That's true.
I think get there another way. I'm fine.
He means that among the elite, he always says there's like over a billion don't believe any religion. That's right.
Yeah.
He doesn't usually say that 6 billion or 5 billion don't believe. Uh-huh. He usually says it's like the Islam, Christianity are 1.5 billion each, and Buddhism is said to be 700 million, but they don't count them in China, so I think they're almost the same as so those are the three big ones.
Uh-huh.
And then secularism is a couple of billion, too, or 1.5 billion. But educated elite, kind of. And then the peasantry might be 3 billion, and they all believe something, you know. You know, they're completely uneducated. There must be as much as all of those combined, practically, by the peasantry. And they do believe, you know. They somehow can't, they don't dare not to believe.
Well, yeah.
I think when they're really suffering badly, they might enjoy believing in nothing, that nothing will await them just once they die. There's nothing bad, you know. But I don't think they feel comfortable with that belief. So, sort of instinctively, people don't really feel that instinctively.
Mm.
Which is why I guess the secularists are so proud of achieving that. And so insisting upon it, something like that. Maybe. I don't know. So what's next for you, Sharon? What's after real love? Or is there anything?
Is there after?
There's no. It's all real love, even beyond nothing.
Yeah, I hope so. It's all real love for a while, I think.
I think so.
Yeah, the book just came out June 6th, so it's pretty new. It's kind of in its infancy.
Yes.
So it's real love for a while.
Yes, it's great. It is really wonderful. I'm so happy about it, of course. And you know, loving kindness, as you know, I always say that loving kindness translation of metta or Maitri is the Asian response to the Christianity that came along with the colonialists, who elevated, you know, love as the highest thing and then proceeded to abuse everybody as a, you know, and extract their wealth and et cetera, enslave them. And so they wanted to use another word, you know, for love, you know. So that's so real love. Now you're really on love.
Which I think yeah.
I think love is loving kindness, right? They're the same.
Yeah, it is.
And friendliness, you know. Friendliness makes it seem easier to achieve. Oh, yeah. What do you think about that argument? How do you respond? You said you get some arguments or some people who say, why should we be happy, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
Like poor Mathieu Ricard, he wrote that tome on happiness because the French, of course, intellectuals, are very anti-happiness. They think it's very la-la Pollyanna, right? So how do you, can you respond to that? Say I play devil advocate and I say, well, I don't want to be happy. I want to get out of this planet. I want to attain that nirvana apart from it all.
Well, I think happiness, in a, like many words, could well be redefined by us, because I think the usage has gotten kind of degraded, like love itself. I think it's another one of those words. Or
that's right.
you know, that I think it's a question of, you know, can we recast the meaning of happiness? So instead of feeling like it means being happy-go-lucky or superficial or something, really redefined as a sense of inner resource, you know, that there's some wherewithal within us out of which will come generosity and resilience and lots of good stuff will emerge from that, but it needs to be cultivated in some way, because life is very burdensome and there's a lot going on, and we get very stressed out and we get very disconnected with ourselves and with others, and our actions may get worse and worse because we're careless, or because we see the world so starkly and rigidly in terms of self and other and us and them. You know, so if you kick a table, that's one thing. If you kick a human being feeling they're just like a table, you're in trouble, you know?
Right. That's good. Yeah, I think you've always been very good at helping people. You were the one, I remember, who brought up the self-loathing thing.
Yeah.
With the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And because I think you've been most acutely aware of how people, either even if they consider themselves secularists, they still have from this, even the secularist side, the kind of view that the human being is kind of worthless. And certainly from the Abrahamic religious side and or even Hindu religious side, you know, most theistic religious side, there's kind of a big put down of the person. Bucky Fuller used to accuse world religions, all of them, including how he understood Buddhism, of giving human beings an inferiority complex, he called it. And sort of trying to make out to them that, you know, life sucks and that's just the way it's going to be. You know, that's the way they misunderstand Buddhism, too. So you've been great in doing in creating antidotes for that and trying to help people build up their self-confidence. And I'm so pleased that you do that. I need it myself.
I can
detect from my WASPy culture, although I never actually, I'm proud of the fact that I never liked God. I didn't believe in it, even as a youth. Although my parents were not church going, but they were not intense atheists or anything. They just weren't church going. And I argued with every minister I could speak to. And when I was dragged to different churches in my youth, and I said, no way, you can't blame it all on one person. But they do put people down, right? They say, you're like worthless. People feel that about themselves.
People feel it. People definitely feel it.
They don't deserve to be happy, or they don't deserve joy with no cause. That would be Satan or something. Even they used to burn people who were too happy, you know, in our Euro-American culture, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's probably more subtle than that these days, you know, but we do suffer a lot from that, and we have, it's another reason that having some sense of community is really valuable, just having people who share your same values, you know, so you don't get swept up in the worldview that's being thrust upon you all the time.
That's right. It is lovely. People may not know that you are a bhakti practitioner too, in your own way. And you love Krishna Das, and you've been working with him for years, and Ram Das, and you teach with them. And so that isn't even Buddhist on some level.
Right.
I mean, formally
speaking. Right.
And yet it is, you know, there is a path of devotion which does redeem, I think, the theisms and people through devotion.
Yeah.
By loving a being who is somehow happy. I mean, Jesus is pretty happy, actually. He hangs out with Mary Magdalene. He has a good supper. He dares to confront the Roman Empire, and then when they try to kill him, they fail, and he rises up again. So, you know, that's why I didn't like the Gibson movie, really, because he looked grumpy. He came out from the cave. I don't know if you saw it. You may not have.
I did not see it.
I know. You know, I wouldn't have gone to see it, but I felt I should. as a religion supposed scholar or something, so I had to see it. And I went with a friend who also didn't really want to see it, so we made a compact that if when one of us jumped up in annoyance to leave, the other one would make them stay. So we actually stayed through it. And to me, the final kicker of all, after all this, the S&M that was going on in it, was that when the actor playing Jesus left the cave after the angel rolled back the rock, right, and his corpse mm-hmm. jumped up and he walked out, which is the way they showed the resurrection, and then a bunch of thunderstorms, he still looked grumpy and mad. You know, it was like assault weapon, or what was mm-hmm. it, those movies, the mega assault or whatever. That series of movies. He looked annoyed. Like, I'm gonna do some comeback, or what do you call it, revenge. You know, and that's so wrong. You know, I love the Russian icons of Jesus. You know, because they tend to really emphasize the resurrection. You know, sort of golden Avalokiteshvara like. You know. Bhakti-worthy form of Jesus, you know, triumphant over the evil and the violence and everything. You know? That's why I really like that aspect. I always like that aspect of Jesus. Of course, everybody likes baby Jesus, but the triumphal rabbi aspect, the magical rabbi, I like that aspect.
Uh-huh.
That's my favorite. Did you go to, by the way, were you brought up Jewish or Christian?
Yeah, I was brought up Jewish.
You were brought up Jewish, did you have a bat mitzvah?
No.
No?
No, bat mitzvah? I mean, that's a more contemporary, my family was more conservative than that.
Really, they were Orthodox?
Yeah, more so.
So what did you think about God and the whole thing?
Well, I understood yearning, you know, which is I think the heart of bhakti, you know. It's like I understood I wanted something other than what I was experiencing day to day, and I had a feeling something was there.
Yes.
Other than what I was experiencing day to day, which is why there were other reasons why I went off to college when I was 16, but I went off to India when I was 18 as a junior in college.
I know. So when you wanted to meditate, before you had meditated, but you got into, you decided meditating was the thing, and you wanted to go to India to learn it.
Yeah.
How did that connect with your rabbinic, you know?
I mean, not really. I mean, the thing about Judaism of that time, because I am not that young anymore, you know, the Judaism of that time was more. It was not about your own personal enlightenment. It was uh-huh. about celebrating the enlightenment of your forebears, you know, and,
uh-huh, right.
and having a familial, ethical life, which was good.
Yes.
You know, but it wasn't about, I don't know if you remember, years ago, you and I were both at this Buddhist Christian conference at Gethsemane Monastery.
That.
And one of the commentators, I think it was Diana Eck, made that point that when... In that case, it was Christianity. In my case, it would have been Judaism. You know, when a Christian representative was speaking, they'd be speaking about a 15th century saint or something like that.
Yes.
And when a Buddhist was speaking, it would be speaking about their own minds or, you know, something in that moment. And that was the difference. So I wasn't interested in abstraction or right. I had those values, you know.
Right,
But I didn't know how to live them. And I had to deal with obstacles and,
right, sure.
you know, my own crazy messed up mind. And so I needed something really direct and kind of problem oriented, you know.
Right.
And this is another thing I got from the Theravada tradition. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on the problem. Let's talk about the hindrances again.
Yes.
You know, or the defilements. Or,
yes.
That's... many people's realistic experience, you know, then we'll work through them.
Yes.
And, you know, cultivate the tools that we need so that they're not really dominating our lives anymore and we've become a different person and we have a different worldview, but there's an awful lot of time spent on those problems.
Yes.
You know, rather than on the solution.
Yes, that's true.
But, you know, what the other state would look like, and so... I'm kind of used to that as well, you know, so.
That's true.
Yeah.
But now, since then, haven't you had many rabbis as students?
Some, yeah, sure, for sure. And it's a whole movement.
They use mindfulness now, right? And they sort of get their sanghas, their communities to contemplate, you know. I've been to synagogues in San Francisco, New York, here and there, and they, and Los Angeles, and they're into meditating.
Oh, totally. And there's one of the big temples on the Upper West Side in New York. I heard the rabbi was leaving to become a mindfulness teacher, and my friend, my colleague, Sylvia Borstein, has quite a number of people.
Yeah, Sylvia is very big on that, yes.
Yeah, her mindful rabbis, you know. And
Yeah,
it's very
different. And I think it's in their tradition, like someone like Rabbi Hillel, in almost the same time as Rabbi Jesus. Jesus was a rabbi, after all. And Rebbe, right? Rebbe means Lama, right? Yeah. Teacher.
Yeah.
And then they had the Hasidics, you know, who were mystical, I think, Kabbalists, right?
Yeah.
The Kabbalists, I think. Hasidics, I guess you could think of more as bhakti, right? But the Kabbalists are more like monastic and mystical. Although I guess they weren't monastic in the sense of celibate necessarily.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I don't think so. And so, you know, it's a very different world within Judaism than it was, you know, because we're talking about almost 50 years ago, as long as you've been married, you know.
That is true. So when we got married in 67, like, where were you then?
I was in high school. I went to college in 68.
So you went to college in 68?
Yes.
In Buffalo there?
Yeah.
And I always ask you this, and then I forget the answer. I'm sorry. Was it Kenneth Inada who was your teacher?
You do always ask me that, and I don't remember. But I can look that up somewhere?
Well, he was teaching Buddhism in that faculty, and he was a translator of Nagarjuna into English.
Yeah, it probably was him, you know, because
I don't see them having two people, you know, the way the religion departments or, you know, big universities do work in America.
Yeah.
Those days especially. So that's really, you know, thank you, Ken. He was a little bit friend of mine. I liked him very much. Ken Inada. He was a trooper, you know. And I think he was a Californian Japanese, like Professor Uno, you know, they suffered the internment that happened during the World War. It's very sad. Injustice done in among second, third, even third, fourth generation Japanese. You know, racist thing, you know, sad thing. Oh, dear. I do love America somehow, as bad as we are. It's so bad. Here and there, the Indians, the blacks, you know, the Asians, and the Muslims now, it's terrible. The Bannon, we have Bannons among us. But I still think it somehow gets exposed here. It's here. It just goes on for centuries quietly in other places around the world, you know.
Yeah. I love America, too. I'm very patriotic, actually.
I know, me too. I do. I like the dream of it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, like China is very, on some level, they're very nationalist and America's enemy number one. And someone was just telling me how they went to Shanghai, and a friend of mine who normally, because of their Tibet connection, can't get into China, but for once they were admitted as a transit thing that was long, so they could actually go into town in Shanghai. And they you know, they went to some kind of place, a club, and they got into like a party thing with the people there. And the great enemy, right, say, you know, America, who's like trying to keep, you know, China from rising in the official thing, everybody in those parties had Mickey Mouse t-shirts, Mickey Mouse watches. They were like culturally, you know, music. They were totally Americanized.
Wow.
In a cultural sort of, they associate fun with America.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they may associate some battleship in the South China Sea. They note that. They take note of that. But the way they live their daily life is like super America. And now, maybe they have to bring back America if we lose it. Well, it's like Xi Jinping giving a big speech at Davos about how he's going to stick with the Paris Accords.
Uh-huh.
Well, we just, our people, supposed rulers, dumped it. What can you say? After we helped push it, you know. I don't know what to say. It's amazing. So that must come, though, from, anyway, from America. So anyway, by the way, another thing I didn't say in my introduction to you, which I should, to tell the people, is you are Dr. Sharon.
Yes.
You have, you know, this great thing about being associated with Buddha. I don't mean enlightened because I'm not, but I mean associated with Buddha is that Buddha lives in the past, present, and future simultaneously, supposedly. That's one of the attributes of enlightenment, as far as any further engagement with helping beings after enlightenment. So Triadvajna, I don't know the Pali way of writing, saying that, dwells in the three times, Triadvajna in Sanskrit, but it must be something like that. And therefore, eventually, Menla Mountain Retreat in the Catskills, which I like to think of as one of your main teaching places, secondary.
Yes, definitely.
Main teaching
place, absolutely.
You were awarded a doctorate. But not only by me, but also by Mark Epstein, who is a MD doctor. I'm a PhD doctor. And we both ceremoniously awarded it, although we haven't invented a proper ceremony, right? Because you're the first.
Ah.
And to receive that. But in the future, of course, we might be officially allowed to do it. Meanwhile, it's on the higher level than official. It's on a real level. Dr. Sharon, because you kept calling us the doctors, right?
Right, Dr. Bob and Dr. Mark.
And you doctor us, you know, about being calm and meditating and being mindful when we work together and when we spend time together. So we awarded that. So Sharon is a doctor of Menla, of the curriculum of Menla, when she comes and teaches and sings and whatever. And we love Sharon there, really. We consider her our core person. We do.
Thank
Although
you
we
so
know
much.
Your primary allegiance is to Barry, which you founded and which still performs its wonderful service for people. And actually, Menla, we can't afford to only be a meditation center by our meditations, because we have to rent it to yogis and you know, Jewish mystics and Christian mystics, wherever it is, on much of the year to pay all the maintenance and the salaries of the people. You know, we don't have enough of our own kind of body of people. We're not a Buddhist-centered, so, you know, immediately. We're the Dalai Lama's, you know, pluralistic, secular ethics center. Shakyamuni Buddha's secular ethics of karma, sorry, but I won't launch into that today. But
you and I get to teach at Menla over New Year's.
Yeah, we did, and every New Year, people should know we're going to be back there.
Yeah.
And are we doing Real Love this New Year?
I think we might be, or maybe working with your enemies, I think, because...
Yeah, well, that's a form of real love, right?
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
they gave the title. I never know what titles to give. But we're going to do that, and we're going to do it more in dealing with the obstacles, right? When you put
that's
real
right.
love in the context of working with your enemies. Right? Love your enemies, right?
Love your enemies.
The book we did, our book. Love
yeah.
your enemies. But, you know, I still regret we didn't use the subtitle. I think I chickened out. I really like the subtitle. You know, people, if they know that book, anybody who's listening, then the subtitle, what is the subtitle, actually?
I don't know what it is now, but...
How to control your anger and be happier or something. I forgot what the subtitle is. But originally, we got the title from a movie of an early Beyoncé, which was called The Temptations, right? The Temptations, about a Southern black choir, black church choir, that won a competition eventually in Atlanta or something. And at the end, there was a thing on the church front where they announced the name of the sermon. Celebrating, and the sermon was celebrating the victory of this choir and how people who were against the choir because they were a little more rock and roll type, you know, like making a had been finally enfolded in the community, and they were really happy with everybody, and there was no more bad guys. It was like a happy ending. And the sermon said, love your enemies, colon, because it will drive them crazy.
Yeah, I like that subtitle a lot.
I do. And then I was on a Canadian interreligious radio show and mentioned it, and I thought I sort of detected a frisson of some Christians feeling annoyed about it. You know, that Buddhists would write that and then say that. And so I chickened out, and that's terrible of me. That's so bad. We have to do a new edition and get that subtitle back.
I agree, actually.
Love your enemies because it will drive them crazy. So that's what people, that's what people in the movement, you know, to try to undo the administration of the country that we feel does not represent us, which we are right. It doesn't, not just the White House either, though Congress too, Ryan and McConnell and company. And that's the thing. By loving them, they'll go crazy and they will self-implode and we'll be free of them. That's the key. But by hating them, then we're fitting into their game and then they'll feel righteous and suppressing us. So that's a means. Love is a strategy, actually.
Yeah, and it's a good strategy.
You know, because we want them to get finally. And in a way, crazy for someone who's doing harmful things means they're getting better. Right? Because they'll be less harmful, you know, when they're crazy. That's the hope. So anyway, so there you are. Sharon, do you have any concluding words or message?
I actually like that last one. You know, it's sort of, I'm going around talking about real love, and it's all like, let's look at love as a strength. Let's look at love as a power, you know, and whether it's love for oneself or love for another being or love for all beings everywhere. And so you just said it well, it's an unusual and radical way of relating to ourselves and to others, including those we consider enemies. And let's do that daring experiment.
Yes. Wonderful. Oh, yes, loving yourself. That's very important. And I think it was from you that I think I finally learned about renunciation, you know, about doing with a little less, about being a little more modest, about taking a little less here and there, you know, being more content with less, you know, less is more sort of thing, you know, which is called renunciation, right, which is very foundational in the meditative path. And that is, and you know, that is always couched in terms of self-deprivation.
Yeah.
But it is actually self-rewarding because you have less to bother with, you know, you get... You're taking sympathy for yourself, finding what are your real sources of pleasure and your real sources of, and not going to excess about anything, you know.
Uh-huh.
That took me years. I think you really triggered me to think about that more and come up with that, I guess, insight, I had, which may be wrong, of course, but I think that was an insight for me. It felt like an insight, you know. The first three paths, you know, renunciation path is actually self-compassion. Why do I need $1 billion? Why am I putting myself through this to get the president, you know?
Right.
It's self-compassion, really. And you are so good at teaching that. Dear Sharon,
I'm so honored
to have you here and to be with you. And we must do it again.
We must do it again.
And really, real love. And I love you. And happy birthday tomorrow.
Yes, thank you so much. Okay. Happy birthday.
Where are you celebrating? In the city? Are you having a party?
I'm not exactly having a party. I'm going to the theater again, which is its own kind of party.
What are you going to see?
I forget what I'm going to see tomorrow. Someone is bringing me. Last night I saw Dear Evan Hansen, which was amazing.
Uh-huh.
And powerful and inspiring. And so... it's wonderful to see great art.
It is.
Turned on by it.
Everybody in my family has been in the theater, but I never go take time to do it. I'm going to do that. That's my resolution. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, have a great birthday. Have a great time at the theater. And lots of love, okay?
Yeah, love to you too.
Okay,
thank you.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Okay.